Here is London, giddy London, is it home of the free or
war? Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. This is Dan Safarik.
And this is Greg Lindsay, and I've summoned you here today, Dan, for a very special episode on London, because a week ago I was in London with my older son, Teddy. It was his spring break trip. I think Harry Potter had incepted the idea into his head, but I wanted to chat about it because while it's fresh in my memory, number one, and number two is that I used it as an occasion to go visit some old haunts from my walking tour with Peter Wynne Rees, a walking tour that you were the one who introduced me to in the Square Mile of London. So before we get deep into, because I want to touch upon my various architectural highlights of London, I want to know, and I want our listeners to know, who is Peter Wynne Rees?
Peter Wynne Rees, at the time that I took a tour with him, which was 2013, was the chief planner. I'm not sure if that was his exact title, but basically the chief planner for the City of London, which for the uninitiated is not the metropolitan city of London of 7-8 million people, but the square mile, the financial district, the core of the City of London, which is its own corporation. This is the City of London Corporation, has its own set of planning protocols. And Peter Wynne Rees was in charge of that for at least two decades. And he has since moved on to become professor of place for the University of College London, the Bartlett School, I believe.
Indeed. And so I took the tour with him 2 years later, inspired by Dan. And if there's one bit of news you can use for all of our listeners is that if you ever find yourself in London with enough advance warning, you too can email Peter Rees and get a 3-hour walking tour of the square mile of London in greater depth than you could ever have imagined. So we'll come back to that. And we're going to have a special bonus episode of this where Dan and I both wrote up our trips with Peter Rees. So you can, you know, hear it in our own voices of our respective tours. Mine was 2015, a few years later. But his voice was ringing in my head, Dan, as I was walking around, because the very first day that Teddy and I arrived, we went to the Tower of London, which I'd never been to. A whole discussion about architecture and building in its own right, 1,000-year history on the site. But I did also use his excuse to take Teddy through the square mile. That was our day there. And a couple of things we can talk a bit more about, sort of, again, my sort of impressions on London post-pandemic. But it was really interesting, number one, to go to the walkie-talkie, I think 22 Fenchurch Street, which is a, oh gosh, is that a Richard Rogers one? I think that's one.
Raphael Vignole, and it's 20 Fenchurch.
20 Fenchurch. See, I would say this is why you are the expert down here. Yes, a Vignole building. And for those of you who are familiar, the walkie-talkie is a building that is bigger at the top, or so it seems, than it is at the bottom, number one. And number two, as a way to get clearance for it, they basically put in the so-called Sky Garden. They put the public space at the top of the building, mm-hmm. which you can get through ticketed entry. And I remember Peter Rees very distinctly pointing out, you know, how much this was a bit of a cheat on their part, but yet it got allowed. But we visited the Sky Garden, Dan, and it was a shit show, I have to say. It was interestingly public in the sense of you could just camp out there for hours and not have to buy anything and you could be there. But it was still ticketed metal detectored entry into the top of a skyscraper. So that was a bit of a, I remember I could hear Peter snickering in my head as we did that one. And then the other part, the other highlight, was that I took Teddy into the Warren of old pubs and coffee houses. When I met with Peter in 2015, that what I wanted from it and got, and it's in my essay, was really sort of understanding like how cities function as information machines. And Peter had this great line, which I still use in talks, that, you know, people make gossip. Gossip makes places. It's all blurring together. But the idea is that basically the city was a machine to bring together people where information spillovers could happen in the form of standing around drinking beer and eavesdropping on people's conversations. And that basically led to new firm, new creation. This is essentially what Jane Jacobs wrote about, and then Paul Romer won a Nobel Prize for in more formal mathematics. But it was, you know, we went to the Jamaica Wine House, which is the site of the oldest coffee house in London, dating back to 1652. Unfortunately, they threw Teddy out. No children allowed there.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. So we tried to go to the George and Vulture, but they were closing up for dinner, which is George and Vulture is where Dickens used to like regularly drink, just literally down this alleyway. And then we went around the corner to a more nouveau pub where Teddy finally got some of his fish and chips. But you know, it's fascinating being back with the Bank of England on one side, and I believe designed by Christopher Wren or Sir John Soane, all blurs together. The Royal Exchange, where Peter and I had coffee and talked about the fact that, like, you know, that's where a lot of the trading happened. And then those coffee houses, where Lloyd's Bank famously started a coffee house. And you know, we've rounded the corner, and there, again, thinking of Richard Rogers, was Lloyd's, which I tried to explain to Teddy, was just the craziest building of, like, just totally turning it inside out and making the structural cores of the envelope, et cetera, et cetera. So I ranted up there, but I'm curious, highlights from your tour with Peter, or, you know, what you remember, and we'll read this aloud for listeners. But
I mean, it was remarkably similar, actually. We went to many of the same places you mentioned. I think
it is a ride. It's like on a track. I got the feeling that he gave me the exact same tour he gave you. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely has its share of pithy quotes, which may have been unique to the situation, and some of which I did record. We went to the George and Vulture. We went to the Royal Exchange. We went through the Leadenhall Market, past the namesake skyscraper, which I think it was still under construction at the time. That's the cheese grater for those of you who are keeping track of all the funny London names for their buildings. And yes, indeed, by Lloyd's. I mean, he was pretty equitable in his treatment of it. You know, he was saying it's a fascinating piece of architecture, but it's also not the greatest building urbanistically. He seemed to be more interested in some of the lower rise buildings that actually had some street frontage that, you know, invited the street in, indeed, for that vital gossip. You know, he's appeared a couple of times on the agenda in all kinds of venues, but some of the venues that we control here at the Council on Tall Buildings, including our 2021 conference in London. And it was interesting to hear him talk post-pandemic, because obviously the gossip machine was severely restricted during those times. And, you know, for the recovery from that, you know, he seems to have become a very strong anti-travel advocate. I think he objects both to the carbon footprint and to the potential for spreading disease. And so he's become a little bit of a localized hermit, and kind of preaching the to the choir of localization, if you will.
Indeed. And I would say, we'll put it in the show notes here. I hosted a podcast with him for New Cities during the pandemic. And so you can sort of hear the line in Winter, you know, both reflecting the fact that he utterly believes the city will be back, and that, you know, that spaces for work, whatever form they take, will be back. But you're right. The whole anti-travel thing was interesting, but he was very much against sort of package tourism as it exists. Peter does leave it sort of open to the idea, which would be interesting to pair him with somebody like Airbnb's Brian Chesky, of like long form travel, you know, and being more embedded in the places you are in. But yeah, Peter's become very anti. He's a fascinating character on many fronts. You know, for those of you who might be slightly aware of him. So Peter, you know, in my interpretation of it, when I chatted with him, he had almost unparalleled power as the master planner of the Square Mile. And I don't believe they even replaced him. They eliminated the position because Peter personally signed off on stuff. And the way he described it is like, it was sort of like negotiations over building envelopes, and, you know, things sort of happen on the backs of pieces of paper versus in formal planning documents. And, you know, it was interesting to hear him describe sort of how that machinery gets made. It is interesting also that, you know, he basically forbade housing being built in the city. The big difference between the Square Mile today and the Financial District in Manhattan, Wall Street, is that that became a quasi-residential neighborhood, at least for those with the means. And he banned housing effectively. He built one residential tower, the Heron, which is the building in which he lives, in which one of the first things he noted to me is that a quarter of the residents had never even picked up the keys because it was that. And he decried the so-called safety deposit boxes in the sky that had happened around the rest of metropolitan London. So it's interesting. We would have had him on, but you know, then we would just be basically dominated by Peter because that's the exact kind of personality he has. But yeah, I thought of him often while I was there. But it was an interesting trip to London in the sense of, so you know, a couple of architectural highlights just to call out. One, we stayed at the Standard London, which is the former Camden Town Hall on Euston Road, across from St. Pancras Station, which is sentimentally probably my favorite building in London. It's just like a confection, right? It's like it strikes me as more Harry Potter than Harry Potter. I can't believe that the train to Hogwarts left from King's Cross and not St. Pancras, although it's more accurate that way. But
King's Cross is actually older, but it's more much more austere.
Yes, they've got the modern extension to it there, where they actually built out, you know, there's a complete Harry Potter gift shop there, and I have a photo of Teddy, like, you know, where they actually have built half of a luggage cart into the wall at the fake platform at 9 3/4, so you can kick your heels up in the air like you're flying through the wall. He loved that. Let me tell you. But it was interesting. So in addition to St. Pancras, which I love so much, is that we also stopped for lunch at a pub called the Blackfriar, right next to Blackfriar Station, which both buildings, St. Pancras and the Blackfriar, were saved in the 1960s from demolition by the poet Peter Betjeman, who basically led those campaigns. There's a statue of him now in St. Pancras, and he's praised at the Blackfriar too. So interesting to see, you know, a Jean Jacobsian figure when it comes to preservation and anti-demolition. So that was interesting. And then the other one architecturally, which I really loved, was we took a trip to Selhurst Park, which is the home of Crystal Palace Football Club. Selhurst Park, as Dan and I both being children of Chicago, I think you would have found it fascinating, Dan, because it is like if you mashed up Wrigley and Old Comiskey in the sense of it is a bandbox from 1924. And when I say it's in a residential neighborhood, I don't mean like Wrigleyville, high streets and bars. Like it's just like housing and like hundreds of people. We surged through the streets to and from Selhurst Park on our way to the trains back to London.
I wonder how the residents feel about that.
I'd be curious. Well, yeah, I'm curious about what it does to their property values and when it comes to that. But it's not a fancy neighborhood either. I mean, it's working class South London. It was, anthropologically fascinating. The only thing we could understand from residents when they talked was the cursing. That's the part that Teddy and I could pick out. He was very excited. The most exciting moment for the entire trip to London is when the opposing fans from Burnley lit off a smoke bomb in the stands near us to protest a disavowed goal from their side. So that was Teddy's got a budding inner hooliganism to him. But I don't know. Those are some of the highlights that jump out there. I would say, yeah, taking the trains, walking 20,000 steps a day. We could also discuss, we went to Coldrop's Yard, which I'll pause here, but fascinating seeing, you know, the so-called revitalization there that's happening around King's Cross, St. Pancras, and, you know, the building of a new Infosphere neighborhood, which, you know, made me wonder about whether it's a bit redundant at this point. But I don't know. I'm curious other highlights from Peter, other highlights from your trips to London.
Yeah, well, again, you know, stunningly, 2013 was the most recent trip that I've taken there. So my experience directly would be quite distant at this point. Of course, in my day job, I'm following development there almost daily. So, you know, from a distance, what I can observe is that yes, there was a huge investment in trying to create regenerated urban neighborhoods that had good walkability and public space, which is all great, but it's all predicated on the idea that there'd be lots and lots of people coming into those offices, which now seems less certain, both for the reasons of the post-COVID situation, but also because of Brexit. Neither of those things was anticipated when, you know, Google, Bloomberg, all those companies laid down big plans to be in central London. To say nothing of Canary Wharf, which was always very dependent on, you know, the financial investment and the financial business being viable there. Although it probably at this point has more housing per square foot than the city of London does.
Oh, I don't doubt that for a heartbeat. It's interesting. I remember, and this will be in the, I think it's in my piece with Peter, is, you know, that Canary Wharf was like a direct response to the city where, I forget the original planner of Canary Wharf who acquired the massive site out there in the former shipyards, you know, was basically ended up being endlessly frustrated with Peter pointing out that, no, you could not knock down that, you know, grade one listed building or, you know, pave over this church to build your massive trading floor square footage. And so they went out and found a site where it was effective. effectively no restrictions on planning and built mini Manhattan. Teddy and I could see it from the top of the walkie-talkie, and it was fascinating just to see that CBD out there. One of these days I'll actually make it out there. I wanted to go there in North Greenwich and see the observatory. But we didn't make it as all the way out there. What's the super tall that's going, or not even super tall, but like the tallest building in London, I think, was finished, and there was another tower going up around it. It did amaze me that there are still, you know, recent skyscrapers there. Which one is it? Is that the Leadenhall Tower, Dan? Or
are you talking about completed or under construction?
I think the one I'm thinking of was completed. There was one under construction next to it, but it was fairly anodyne. There was nothing wacky about it, as Peter would say.
Yeah, you're probably talking about 22 Bishopsgate.
Yes, that's it. The tallest tower in the city.
Yeah, which is kind of like, they can't even really come up with a clever name for it. I think people have, the best anyone shot at it, from what I could remember, was the Wedge.
I was going to say like the sliver to go with the shard, but yeah, exactly. With the shard already taken, it's a little hard. I was actually shocked at its fairly nondescriptness there. But
well, there's quite a story behind that building, actually, because not so much the building itself, but the original building that was supposed to have gone up on that site was called the Pinnacle, and it was a much more adventuresome design. In fact, it was like a twisting design, not totally unlike the one that Bjarke Ingels has actually executed on the west side of Manhattan with the spiral, and it was going to be called the Pinnacle, delayed by financial difficulties stemming from the 2007-2008 crash. But they were going to call it the Helter Skelter, which is the British term for a circular children's slide on a playground.
That's so cool. I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry we did not get the Helter Skelter as a nickname. Okay, I'll drop in just for Peter. My favorite Peter quote from the tour was him pointing out that, you know, that everyone came to him with plans for wanting an icon. As he points out, an icon is a third rate, like religious gimmick, you know, in the literal sense there. And then in striving to have an icon, what they ended up with was wacky buildings, which are not quite the same thing. So
that's a really good point. Yeah, icon has sort of become, you know, the default four-letter word that developers try to use to push their buildings wherever they are. In fact, the number of iconic towers, like literally named iconic tower, in our database, I think surpasses more than we can load on one page.
Amazing.
Which sort of, devalues the word. And then when you consider that the origin of the word is actually basically referring to tacky souvenirs, it's kind of funny.
I never found it. This was a district that has sort of been, well, yeah, again, reclaimed from scratch, reclaimed from industrial properties and old warehouses just north of King's Cross. It's sort of very much affiliated with Thomas Heatherwick. For whatever reason, and also has the Google Landscraper, which is still under construction. I was shocked to see it in person, Dan, because, you know, it looks big in renderings, but when you're there and realizing its size and then marveling at the fact that, like, yeah, how many people will ever occupy this building was impressive. But the thing, the big takeaway is, like, I'm curious, like, when do we finally change? What is the vibe shift, to borrow the current phrase here, when it comes to like some of these urban redevelopments? Because it was just fascinating to see, like, I'm curious, like, do planners, like, I guess Tom Dixon was the name of the company that's very much also affiliated with Cold Drop Yards, but like the kit of parts there when it comes to cool boutiques, cool restaurants, all assembled there. I mean, you know, we sort of affiliated with hipster gentrification combined with knowledge worker jobs and sort of, you know, modern towers and the sort of thing. I'm just curious, like, I would love to read a deconstruction of the, how do individual decisions by developers amount to this incredible sameness of these projects in cities around the world? And the results are not bad. I don't want to criticize it as, you know, certainly it's better than the alternative, but it's just sort of fascinating of, like, you know, this, like, this sort of emblem of this. And it's true whether you see it like, you know, I could take Cold Drop Yards and compare it against what Kushner Properties did with the former Watchtower building complex in I think what's now called Dumbo Heights in Brooklyn, you know, wedged between Dumbo and Brooklyn Heights, you know, the same sort of identikit of, like, you know, of very well-designed minimalist restaurants and things. I guess I'm sounding a bit like a middle-aged old man here, but it is just sort of fascinating to see, like, you know, this sort of accumulation of details, and it has the same eerie feeling of sameness everywhere. I wonder how we break free of that paradigm, where like what at least aesthetically would lead people in opposite directions. But anyway, I don't know. I'd be curious to know. Like, I would love to see the flow chart that leads to these decisions always ending up in sort of the same place.
I think these are all, you know, I think it has a large, well, I think just like any sort of copycat or cookie cutter, you know, development aesthetic, you know, it has to do with the financialization of the real estate business on a global scale. It's less obvious when you're trying to create something that feels bespoke, that feels authentic, but there is a playbook for that. And the playbook does come, I think, from a relatively few urban planners who can work at the scale, which is, of course, you know, a word that, you know, you like to use quite a bit and, you know, is throughout your work. It just sort of seems like if people were working at a smaller, more localized scale, we might see more original derivations of this urban regeneration model, which is, again, to say the alternative is far worse, which is, you know, mowing it down and replacing it with something that's utterly banal and corporate. But I agree, you know, every city sort of wants a high line. Every city sort of wants, you know, a brickworks district, for lack of a better generic term. And one wonders, you know, what the global capacity for that is.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, we mentioned, you know, wants a high line. I love the fact that Diller and Scafidio and Renfro were so shameless that they literally did just build carbon copies of their park for people. I say places, and again, back to current events here. I mean, I've resigned myself in the last few weeks that I guess I never will see Moscow again. I'd been making plans to potentially go to, you know, the Moscow Urban Forum again this year, and then that'll never happen. But their Zaridi Park is, you know, the version they built there near Red Square for that. And then I think they did build one in London, although I think it's out near Greenwich, but savaged by the architectural press. I remember I think Owen Hathaway's and others ripped it to shreds, or Ollie Wainwright did. Apologies for that. So yeah, you know, it's interesting when you say that that carbon copy. But that's interesting, and it comes back to like, I mean, this, you know, we started this podcast series with Venice, and here we are in London. And yeah, I think that was like the one thread. And this is, I don't know, this is larger questions about preservation and Jane Jacobs and others, her conservative streak is like, you know, obviously our resources, wealth, financialization, timescales due to computation, this larger sort of cultural thing where like this compression to now that is fundamentally incompatible with building good urban places, which require many hands and many generations. And that's why, like, yeah, the ultimate resource is it's like a fossil fuel of urbanism, of these, you know, critics would probably say preserved in amber, using that metaphor. But ultimately, like, you just simply can't produce places like, you know, like the Georgian Vulture and Jamaica Winehouse and San Marcos in Venice, those kinds of things. And it is interesting that, you know, I talked about this recently with somebody else. Like, it was interesting being inside the process of Cohn Peterson Fox, which is exactly sort of one of those firms that has that expertise, and talking to Jamie Van Klemper, who I think he's one of the heads of your organization now, or ceremonially. But Jamie, who's, you know, was brilliant and very committed to this, you know, walked me through in 2007, they're planning for Songdo, South Korea. And it was meticulous and smart. And I still marvel at the fact that, like, when you have a team, even if you have 40 really well-intentioned, committed architects and urban planners, there's just like a level of resolution that you can't get below because you're planning the city or district from half a world away. And yeah, and that leads to there's an uncanny valley effect in urbanism when it comes to that, when like you can just see the master's hand, but not that level of fine-tooth degree and changes. So I don't know. It is interesting. Perhaps it leads to that. And yeah, it'll become a place over time. I mean, I'm a fan of Songdo ultimately, because like you could see weird sprawling urbanity had come up to the edge of the site that KPF was doing, and like eventually it would mold it into some place. But I don't know. I guess that's a task for all of these neighborhoods from scratch.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't speed evolve something. You know, cities accrete over time, and you know, the older the city is, obviously, the more accretion there is. You know, a lot of cities in Europe had decisions about renewal made for them in the form of bombing campaigns, which unfortunately we're seeing the return of in Ukraine right now. You know, so places like the Barbican and other brutalist icons in places like London, Berlin, and elsewhere, you know, came up because of necessity. The inner core of the city was destroyed by activities in World War II. But, you know, the remark of that I remember that Phyllis Lambert made about North American cities was that we didn't have the war come here. We did this to ourselves. We cut these huge swaths through cities that were, you know, perhaps a bit messy, but it was in favor of these master planned, you know, grand ideas that resulted in lots of vacant plazas and kind of desolate spaces. That's not exactly what's happening with the urban regeneration by fiat. You know, it's a little more pleasant than all that. I think we can still create places that people want to go as long as they are somewhat integrated with the accretions that have already happened. So while there is a certain playbook for doing that, for meshing your new plan into the old city, if you're starting with something that's totally new and you're doing tabula rasa or building over even something like Hudson Yards, you know, is pretty famously desolate, you know, built over real estate that didn't previously exist, built over the rail yards. You see how that can go wrong, even in a city that's got a well-established urban fabric.
Well, I say the next time we travel together, I say London. We've been, you and I have been to Tokyo together and Venice together and couple other cities, but we haven't done London. But we should do travel challenge to go out to the Stratford Olympic site and see how that regeneration project's going, because that, of course, was done with great care and planning to sort of, you know, inject investment into, you know, obviously traditionally the neglected sort of quarter of London there. And I'm curious to see how that's going, because I was thinking when you were commenting just now, and I did see that site, I don't know, 2014, 2015, I think maybe on that Peter Rees trip, I went to go see and visit the site of the factory space of Assemble, which of course won the Turner Prize for their incredibly elaborate acupuncture revitalization in, I believe it was in Liverpool, Granby Four Streets, where like they literally went into homes that had been ruined and fabricated objects and tile to replace them. Assemble is I find them really interesting practice. And their space got demolished, Dan, as the punchline, because that was part of the long-term revitalization plan for Stratford, where IKEA's holding fund is actually financing the construction of housing out there. A move that got misinterpreted by many, that they were going to build like an IKEA, you know, fake neighborhood, but really it's more the notion of like IKEA needed to park those profits somewhere, and so it was literally investing in land. And I think Tesco was actually doing the same. I thought it was really interesting that these high street retail brands were building housing districts as a way to basically, you know, search for yield in the financial environments. So I'd be curious to see how that's going. Next time I'm in London, I'll have to catch up with Ricky Burdett, LLC Cities, who I invited to speak at Resite in 2018 and talked a bit about some of that project along with one of the members of Assemble. So
we will have to get Ricky next. Maybe we can get him on the podcast. That would be a dream, yeah?
Oh, yeah. I'd love Ricky. For those of you who don't know, Ricky is like, I mean, Ricky's been on every Blue Panel commission in London, and has this, you know, incredible voice. But yeah, Ricky has forgotten more about urbanism than Dan and I will ever know, and you know, has played a direct hand in many of these sort of planning schemes. So he'd be a great guest we should have in the future. All right. Well, on that note, I say I should probably run here momentarily, because I'm jumping on another plane in a moment, this time to go to Austin, Texas, which I will not have enough time. I've never been, interestingly enough, Dan. It's one of the top three cities, and I'm curious to hear your list. Top three cities in North America that I have not been to. I've never been to, well, I should add Guadalajara into this list as well, a wonderful Mexican city, but, you know, neglected, but quite large, and I've never been there. I've been to the CDMX. But yeah, if we count U.S. and Canada, the three most significant cities that I've never been to as of the moment are Vancouver, Austin, and Pittsburgh. Never had a chance to make it out there. So I'm very excited to see it, but I will not have a chance to tour the housing insanity. I'm very curious to see the unincorporated areas on the east side where people are building Airbnb mansions for long-term rental and some of the utter crazy urban form there. But at least I'll finally get to see, you know, if Austin is in fact still weird. Have you ever been?
I have, but I was there in 1995 when South by Southwest, you know, was taking walk-ins like me.
I would say, was Bruce Sterling still hosting the closing party at his house? He used to famously do that, I think, in the 80s in some of the early versions of that one.
Well, I didn't witness that, but I definitely saw the dude who plays bass on Sixth Street, who was in who's in Slacker, and you know, all the sort of fixtures. It was weird enough then, although I will say that we stayed at the condo of an IBM executive who had a very fun sports car that I drove and then got pulled over in rural Texas, only to discover that it had no, the insurance had expired. So that was interesting.
That is so awesomely Texas.
It was very Texas.
It was funny talking about urban regeneration for a moment. Like, it's, yeah, I mean, I can't imagine I'm going to pick this up in, like, you know, a day trip. Literally, I'm there 24 hours to talk to a real estate group. So I think their location pick for the conference is probably not accidental there. But yeah, it'll be really fascinating because, of course, you know, the only thing worse than, like, long-term entrenched poverty in your city is to then have someone drop a ton of wealthy people on it overnight. Ground zero in America, like the whole phenomenon of, like, wealthy Californians and New Yorkers, like, blowing up housing markets in Nashville and Austin and Boise and others. So I don't know. I'd be curious. Next time we chat, I'll see what details I can glean at street level. The version I always had of that one is, like, it was my one and only trip to Portland, Oregon, on my book tour, where basically, like, the only hostile crowd I ever faced during my book tour there from, you know, the keep it weird, keep it local Portlandians. But my interviewer at Powell's, you know, worked for, like, you know, the magazine, the city magazine, Portland. And he was wondering which crowd it was, because as he pointed out, like, you know, Portland, for example, is full of Intel executives. And there's a Maserati dealership on the main drag there as well. So the sort of interesting divide there of, you know, those kinds of cities of, like, keep it weird, keep it local, and yet very happy to indulge in global flows of capital and wages there to pump up their local economies. So.
Well, I think you could have said the same thing about San Francisco, you know, a generation ago.
Indeed, Baghdad on the Bay and Herb Cain, and once one of America's weirdest sui generis places. It's like, imagine, like, New Orleans became the tech center of America. It's almost kind of similar that way.
I'd say don't rule it out, but I think if you're looking at climate models, it's probably unlikely.
Well, you know, of course, but in the sense of, like, I mean, like, San Francisco is not one of, like, you know, Americans' prototype cities. Like, you know, it's obvious urban framework and the topography and the weather and everything else there. Like, it strikes me as, you know, I mean, obviously, and it didn't even, obviously. I mean, it was obviously the Valley, which is much more prototypical. You know, all the semiconductor guys going there in the 60s, you know, where there was cheap land and warm weather kind of thing. And then sort of slowly turning the Bay into their bedroom community is a very interesting phenomenon, too.
I will look forward to your dispatch from Austin, and then in a month's time or so, I should have a dispatch from Vancouver and Portland, as it happens, because I will be going to the International Mass Timber Conference in Portland, and perhaps visiting some of my old haunts. I used to live there, but I have not been there since 2009. I expect it's changed quite a bit.
Interesting. Well, I mean, like, obviously Vancouver, the center of that as well, too. I might actually have a Vancouver trip coming up because my boy's passports are expiring the first week of June. We can only get them renewed in Canada at a U.S. embassy or consulate. And the only U.S. consulate currently accepting appointments right now is Vancouver's. I may have to fly across a continent, Dan, so that my children get their passports. So we'll see if I turn that into my finally get a chance to take that one off the list as well.
But it's also a charming city, although one with considerable amounts of generic construction, which I can definitely revisit after I've refreshed myself of its many vistas.
Well, that's good. Well, we can compare that then to Toronto. I will note, and we should wrap this up momentarily, but I will note that that Tyler Brûlé, favorite son of Canada, Jason Tyler Brûlé, you know, whose mother still lives in Ottawa, or grandmother, 103-year-old grandmother, wrote his most recent dispatch in the Monocle newsletter this weekend, where he complained about, you know, Toronto. The Toronto looked worse than ever with its empty, you know, graceless towers, bike lanes that no one uses. Of course, Tyler would probably want people to I think he called for them to dump snow into the bike lanes to make more space for cars, because that's how he rolls that way. And then heaping more abuse onto Canada for having any sort of restrictions around COVID, while muttering an interesting, intrigued note about Miami that he'd never been a favorite, but perhaps he should bring the Monocle staff back there. So I can't wait to see how Monocle approaches, you know, the tech bros and crypto mayor of Miami.
Yeah, well, that is a whole podcast by itself. The problematic ways of Tyler Brûlé.
There you go. We'll get to that. But all right. Well,
I missed your flight.
Yes, I'm off to catch a flight. We'll be doing this. I say we'll find some more guests for listeners. But a few weeks from now, Dan and I will be doing this perhaps in the same room when he visits Montreal. And so we'll have a special Montreal themed hangout episode as well at some point.
Vive la Canada.
All right. All right, Dan, I'll wave to you on the way to Texas.
All right.